Welcome to Holden Village. Ann Parfit will be speaking on genetic markers, waiting to be a patient. Let's listen in on Ann.
This session is going to deal with a number of issues regarding genetics and genetic engineering. It ties into this summer's theme at Holden Village, which is a foretaste of the feast to come, in that we recognize that there is a plausible vision of the final future, and that we know the end of the story. We know what is coming at the end of what we conceive of as being time, time being a human construct, and we know that that future is coming to us through the eschaton. Now, to think of that and then think of genetics is to position the eschatological future versus the future as seen through genetics. And we're going to look at some of those issues today. There are a number of ethical issues encountered in the practice of eugenics or genetic marking. And the ones that I'm going to keep top of mind or review as we go along are, first of all, privacy. What is it? And who owns information? Not only about us as individuals, but also as members of a community. And we're going to look at the rights of members of the community and who makes the decisions about the information in terms of our public health and in terms of our personal and individual health and our lifestyles. We'll also look at ethical issues about individual rights and the public good, and that's how we move from privacy into ethics. We look at the right to know what our genetic markers are, what we might be susceptible to if the information is indeed out there. Do we have a right to know it? Or would it be inhuman to give us this information? What would we do with it? What if the information is not so good? Or do we have a duty to know? Because that could influence our lifestyle change decisions, whether or not we marry, whether or not we have children. There are issues involving paternalism and the fear on the part of doctors and researchers and other people who suspect that if we knew some of the things about ourselves, that we would make decisions not entirely freely. We might even go so far as to end it all if we knew we had some diseases. So then we ask, do we really want to know? How would knowing affect that decision-making or our quality of life? What about employment screening? What about children and the test? What about in utero testing? Those are all the ethics issues that we'll look at as we work through this particular issue. As many as 15 million Americans suffer from moderate to severe genetic diseases. And at this point, at the time that this research was done, there were more than 2,200 hereditary disorders established. That is, they could look at DNA and they could say, 2,200 particular genetic diseases or disorders can be found on DNA. They said that they had another 2,100 that were suspected. Now, this information is 3 or 4 years old, and they've been doing a lot since then. The National Institute of Health has been funding studies across the United States in universities, and so this information is even old at 3 years. Many of the genes are recessive, meaning that a child will pick up the condition only if both parents carry the gene. Knowing, however, that you are carrying the gene is important because you might have a susceptibility that would be linked to genetic causes such as alcoholism, coronary heart disease, colon cancer, Huntington's disease, PKU. PKU is a particularly good one to look at in terms of historical background, because in the 60s, prior to the 60s, there was some genetic engineering being done. And at that point, the research was stopped because it was being portrayed in the media as being Frankenstein-like. Hmm. And that negative media attention put a halt to the funds that were going into eugenics or genetic engineering and testing at that point. But early in the 1960s, there was a prenatal predictive test that made it possible to identify in newborns a tendency toward PKU. And that's also called the sweaty socks disease, if you've ever heard of that. In newborn babies, when you hold them, they smell like sweaty socks. And it's important to know that the baby has that tendency or that disease, because if you put them on a special diet, you can prevent retardation that will assuredly occur if that special diet is not administered. The test for PKU is cheap and it's easy, and the solution, modifying the diet, is an easy one. So that opened the door, or opened the window, so that genetic engineering had some possible positive favor in the eyes of persons who were then trying to decide whether or not any money should go into it. The question today is that if all screening were so specific and for such a treatable condition, inexpensive, and we could find a solution, then genetic testing would be routine and the questions would be floating away, or at least that's the question we pose. If we could do it easily, and if we could do it for specific instances, would we then do it? And the question is usually answered most assuredly yes.
Is that the test where they just put a drop of something on the dye curve, and if it changes the color, that shows if they have PKU?
It's an excess of phenylalanine, an amino acid, and it doesn't say here how the test is done.
I think that's what it is.
Is it?
I read it in a child development class.
Okay.
They just, you know, like if it turned brown or something, they had it, they just tested.
Well, that makes sense, because it would be presence of an amino acid, so mm-hmm. It sounds
so
like something.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's easy to treat, as I said. And one of the things they do is they add iron to the diet, among other things. I mean, it's simple stuff that sounds simple anyway to me. In 1965, there was screening done by someone called Jacobs, and his team found that there were some men who had an extra Y chromosome, and that many of the people who were inmates in prison and mental institutions carried this extra Y chromosome. So then they posited that, gee whiz, this extra Y chromosome, if we looked at everybody, at the entire population, would that show a tendency toward antisocial behavior? Some newborns were subsequently tested, and they were followed to see if the XYY caused that antisocial behavior. They weren't able to come up with any significant definitive answers, because there were all kinds of other factors, including the babies and the children being washed, so they weren't sure how much was being influenced by environment and how much was being influenced by this extra chromosome. So there are those kinds of things that are out there that are suggested, at least in the media, that make us a little bit wary of, gee, what if you find out that you are a newborn and, you know, your baby's a newborn and has an extra Y chromosome, then what do you do? There are some ethical questions to be answered there. In the early 1970s, it became possible to screen for the chromosomal aberration that we call Down syndrome. And so pregnant women over the age of 35 routinely are tested today. In fact, it's malpractice for a doctor not to suggest and even recommend that women over the age of 35 who are pregnant be tested for Down syndrome. In other words, if you are over 35 and your doctor doesn't suggest this, you can charge him with malpractice if the baby's born with Downs. This is called susceptibility screening, and it's possible not only for things like Down syndrome, but also for cholesterol and lipids and HLA antigens. Some of the genes seem to be linked to certain diseases, for example, to cancers and multiple sclerosis. Discrimination is the question with some of these diseases. If we are aware that we have this predisposition, and we can minimize medical costs by screening out prospective employees, then we get into some pretty scary potential situations. Genetic markers, then. I'm going to skip back a little bit. There are probably 4,000 diseases that are inherited. And basically, the way that people find out about genetic markers requires a variety of information. First of all, it requires some blood from grandparents. So if grandparents are not alive, then it's not going to be possible to get a real good genetic marker. But they like to have three generations of information. So they want the grandparents, the parents, and the child, the youngest person. And they want that blood as well as family history. And they're able to do what is called Mendelian inheritance tests. Some diseases like cancer and manic depression and schizophrenia involve those kinds of genetic cofactors where you're looking at an entire family and the consistency of the disease among members of the family. Some diseases skip generations, some do not. So sometimes if say a parent does not want to be tested, but a grandparent feels very strongly about being tested, and a child is suspected of having a disease, then if the grandparent is tested and the child is tested and they come up positive, then the parent absolutely has that tendency toward that disease, is carrying that gene somewhere in their family. They're carrying it in the family. The parent is also carrying it. So the genetic cofactors are involved. At some point, there was nothing. At this point, we know that there's nothing that can be done about some diseases except ameliorate symptoms. We just can't get rid of these diseases. So we ask ourselves whether or not we should go through this process of using blood tests and family histories to predict who's carrying a dormant genetic disease. This is tough stuff. People who have some of these diseases, like Huntington's, are, if they know that they have a disposition toward Huntington's, are living with a genetic sword that I would suspect, I'm only imagining, I don't know, must be like the sword of Damocles, just over their heads, constantly wondering whether or not this is going to show up and at what point and what will happen. So we take that concern for one another, and we look at the ethical issues. And the first one that I listed earlier was a right to know. To many people, it seems obvious, just absolutely obvious, that persons who are at risk for certain genetic disorders would have a right to know. Childbearing decisions, children might not be born because parents erroneously fear the disease, so the test can say, no, you're going to be fine, have a baby. Or may tell you, no, don't have a baby. You absolutely have a predisposition toward this. So we have a right to know in order to find out that we can have babies without fear, or that we can make a decision that we're going to go ahead knowing that there's a risk there. And with Huntington's, it's a 50-50 risk. So there is a right to know. But then is it inhuman to tell, right? Is that the correct pronunciation? It would be inhumane, but it's inhuman to tell. Whatever. And so we look at whether or not a person with regard to Huntington's should be told, because certainly that person is likely to die an early death, and it's a terrible death. So would it be inhuman to tell someone this information and knowing that you can't offer any treatment, knowing there's nothing that you can do? Wouldn't it be better to wait until some kind of positive treatment can be given before we begin disseminating this information about individuals to them? Is a person's right to know so strong that person can exercise it even if no help is available? The right to know argument works best for negative results. I have a right to know that I don't have the disease. If the results are positive, some victims, and here we use the word victim because no one is at fault, yet there it is. Some people will say that they wish they hadn't taken the test. Yet it's easy for people who challenge that individual autonomy to say, avoiding the question is something that you just can't do. You have the right to know, and as an individual, you exercise your autonomy. So then will people with positive results just be able to walk away and deal with it by themselves? Then what do we do with individualism? Excuse me. Perhaps the most humane thing to do with these things is to remind ourselves and others that these tests are not 100% accurate. There is some uncertainty that allows for a hope of error even when there's a positive test result, but that only goes so far. Early evidence implies that society should be extremely careful about revealing devastating news when we can do nothing at all about the effects of that news. Some people would reply, sure, why not? Let's have the test. But we already know about people having HIV, which is not AIDS, but which results in AIDS in some cases, and about cancer, and both of those lead to death. So despite the newness, what's so different about genetic testing and finding out about those particular diseases? Are people making an unjustified exception with regard to diseases that are found out about through genetic testing versus diseases that are found out about through some other means, such as testing blood for AIDS or for HIV? So we look at the right to know, and we look at whether or not it's inhuman to tell people that they have these diseases, and we question those ethical standards. Beyond that, we've touched on whether or not we have a duty to know in terms of whether or not we should have children. And in one case, there was a medical class, and a man came in and he said, I'm deciding not to take this test, and here are all of my reasons. And the reasons were honored, and the class ended, and people started to walk out of the room. And then from the back of the room, there was a woman, and she yelled out, and she said, what about me and the kids? And it was the man's wife. Now, she wanted to be able to plan the future of this family, and the disease that they were discussing was Huntington's disease. If her husband was positive, she would be taking care of him. In the second stage of Huntington's disease, people who have Huntington's disease generally become highly promiscuous, and they have been described, according to the research here, as interested only in constant animalistic sex with their partner, and not just with their lifetime partner, but with anyone. So this woman probably wondered, the research says, if she could take that. And beyond that, what about medical care and custodial care and the children? It might still be possible to purchase life insurance before the tests are done. Huntington's makes relatives suffer as much as the people who have it. The disease is horrible. It affects the entire family, as many as these diseases do. So should the husband have been pressured to take the test? And does he have a duty to do so to save his family from some of the things that they might not know about until the last minute before it's too late to prepare, at least in terms of insurance? And we'll get back to that later. Should they have a right to buy insurance? Suppose an intergenerational person, Fred, refuses the test because he doesn't want to know his fate. He doesn't want to know. And I mentioned this a minute ago. And suppose that the grandfather and his son take the test, then certainly his right to know will be voided because he will absolutely know, because his father and his son have the disease, that he must have it too. What if a husband is positive with Huntington's or some disease like it, and he won't tell his children, doesn't want them to know? What if there's a genetic counselor involved, and the counselor knows that the father's not telling the family and the children? As the children approach childbearing age, the counselor could agonize over whether or not the children should be told. Should this at-risk child become pregnant, or should the at-risk child have the right to have the tests and find out whether or not they're going to pass on the gene? If the child knew that her father were positive, what would she do in terms of taking care of that parent? How would that affect her marriage decisions, whether or not she's in the sandwich generation between taking care of children and taking care of parents, both of whom need her? So then the counselor needs to make decisions about whether or not to break patient confidentiality. And those are medical questions that get involved. What's the duty to know and the duty to tell? What about preventing suicide and paternalism? People who are positive with these diseases often consider suicide. And they say suicide is not unreasonable. It's not so awful that we can't discuss it or consider it. And yet the doctors say, well, the suicide is caused by depression. And that's treatable. So we can treat the depression even if we can't treat the disease that's causing the depression. So we don't want suicide, and they won't support that. Patients should only be submitted to the burden of truth that they can carry, say the doctors, with a paternalism edge to that, paternalistic edge to that.
How do they know?
They don't know.
A lot of times the families will kind of tell them. I ran into this a lot. My fourth child was born with Down syndrome, and there's a lot of families who will just tell the doctor, make the decisions, don't involve me in it because it's too hard, and I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
Don't want to know.
And make what decision, though?
Treatment or telling?
Treatment, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
That's not unusual. It's really not. And that puts the doctor in a position where doctors 20 years ago were accustomed to being paternalistic. It was the way we expected our doctors to be. And now, since the 1970s, when biomedical ethics really took off, doctors are much more aware that there is a relationship, and patients expect to be able to make decisions. They expect the information to be given to them. This is what they're being taught in medical schools now. You will not make all the decisions. You allow the patient the right to make his or her own decisions. Then what do we do? We've got a doctor who's between the old way of being paternalistic and the new way of being very careful not to make decisions for patients and then being charged with malpractice.
Ones that I noticed were all moving on to a C position of, do you want to make all the decisions and know everything, or do you want me to take care of it and able to go with either way? So,
There are different ways we look at our doctors. We look at them in terms of whether or not they are being paternalistic, whether or not they are technicians who have all this information, and they are simply, the guy doing the technical stuff. He looks in the book, he looks at your body, he says, this is what we're going to do, and he engineers a solution for you. And then we consider our doctors to be our friend, and they're going to go ahead and work this out with us and walk down the aisle with us and arm in arm and just feel the pain as much as we do. And then there's the model of the doctor who is side by side with you but not next to you but facing you and saying, here's what's happening, and you say, here's what's happening on my side, and together you come to a decision on what needs to be happening. What needs to happen with the cure or the treatment of the disease. There are lots of models, and we're moving, as you said, through those stages. And doctors, depending on when they were trained and what their family background is and their expectations, doctors frequently are, we still find that many doctors are children of doctors. So there's that family expectation that falls through too. So all of those things need to be considered, and it's not just a patient who's involved, but also the patient's family and the community, and that community includes the medical team. So all these ethical issues keep running up with regard to genetics. So please continue to interrupt me with these things, because otherwise it's going to be a monologue, and that's not fun for me either.
Is genetic therapy proceeding apace with genetic diagnosis? In other words, the markers, talk about 4,000 some
markers,
diseases that can be marked or flagged or however, to a certain structure, lack of it or whatever it is. There's also a lot of talk about, gene splicing, gene therapy. Is progress being made on that front as well, so that what well may be a serious ethical decision in 1995 will become a PKU sort of thing 10 years from now?
Not on all those diseases. By and large, not on most of them. At this point, the money just isn't there. NIH has put millions of dollars into this kind of research in the last 2 years, but it's slow research. They're still trying to map it, and the mapping is where the money's going right now, and the treatment will follow. But it's not like they map one and they go and do a treatment for that one, and they map another and they do a treatment for that one. They're still mapping. That's where we're at with it. So that's why these are the tough ethical questions.
I think it's almost has a Frankensteinish feel to it to a lot of the population.
Will we still
be doing that kind of stuff? That's why the money's not there, and that's why it's not being publicized.
Well, but, yes.
But just to clarify, okay, when we talk about treatment, we're talking about the treatment for the disease. For someone who has that disease.
Yes.
Is that what you were saying? It sounded like you were saying genetic engineering, where you identify someone as having problems and that you're going to go in and alter their genetic makeup.
You can.
That's a whole different for a while.
Yeah, that's
in
gametic.
My mind, anyway.
Yes, there is somatic and there is gametic. Uh-huh. And I was hearing somatic, and maybe you're talking about gametic.
I was talking the proactive.
Okay. Thing. They are doing some of that at this point, not a lot, because they just don't know how. If you have in utero testing for fetuses and you find certain things that you can deal with, yes, some of those are being treated in utero, but they just don't have that much data at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but there are two things that they found. Sometimes they can make changes that will simply deal with the disease and leave the person the same. Other times, when they deal with the disease, it changes the person. So, I mean, that's where we get into this Frankenstein.
You're talking about after birth or in
utero? In utero.
In utero. Right?
In utero.
Okay. And what's an example of that? Can you
I get all the diseases mixed up. So as we go through it, if I come to it, I'll pull it out. But yeah, there are a number of them that they're looking at and working on in utero.
Spina bifida, maybe?
That's what I'm thinking, but I don't want to say that until I get
and
to it.
And they're working on that, or they can do something for that?
It's identifiable in utero, and I believe they are doing some surgery in utero.
I don't see.
At this point.
That's different from genetic engineering.
Is it also true to say that there probably is no example in civilization where available technology has not, in the long run, been applied in that some time or another? You know, all the way from the spinning mills there in England when people were objecting to that.
Mm-hmm. Since Kant.
Throughout all of our existence, there may be a protest here, a protest there, ethical problems with genetic mapping or its effects, or even the analysis of your supermarket ticket to know what your buying preferences were for marketing. People may object to that privately, but in the end, there's really never really been any example in civilization where if technology is available, we're going to use it.
In terms of medicine, that's particularly true since about the mid-1700s. Up to that point, and in the old Middle Ages, not the high Middle Ages, but the old Middle Ages, people were not even doing autopsies on bodies, because that would be desecration of the body, and that was against the Bible, or biblical teaching as it was then understood. And so we had no medical information at all. And medicine started when these kinds of autopsies were done. Corpses were stolen. People would die and the corpses would be stolen so that they could be find out what's inside there and see what it looks like and how it works and what it does. And
Da Vinci did that.
Yeah, Da Vinci did a lot of that. A lot of people did a lot of that, but it was all very secret. At the same time, we had different ideas of death and dying, and that was a very a long-term ceremony. People gathered around the bed, and that whole and how we die was a very different thing. Once we began to allow ourselves to investigate the body and we moved forward with this technology, we have not stopped. But up to that point, we had some biblical intervention that said, no, we can't do that because that says they say no in the Bible. And that was a biblical interpretation that held at that time that we have since been able to understand it with greater understanding of the Bible, and we don't hold to that being what that means. But yeah, if we've got technology, we use it. So then...
My point was, if that's true, then ethics really has to pick up the pieces.
Ethics like is just...
On. Yeah,
after
you know...
After it's been done, then we say no.
The whole idea of what's right, really, you can try to forestall it, you can try to predict it. What would we do if this happens? But in the end, we're really forced to be picking up the pieces of a deterministic technology that will be applied, whether for benign or neutral purposes or not.
Well, I will interject my personal opinion at this point in terms of the ethics of some things that are going on now, just because it's current. When President Clinton came into office, the first bill that he signed was the one that allows the use of aborted fetuses for research. First bill that was signed. And I was, and still am, furious about that. It has nothing to do with anything other than it only goes halfway. That's a halfway solution. We are allowing this tissue to be used for research, which they say is a good thing, because otherwise we just throw it away and no good comes of evil. On the other hand, what are we doing to support people who are becoming pregnant so that they don't become pregnant again, or so that they can make a decision about whether or not to abort based on whether or not they can get some support? What are we doing to support that situation? If we're going to do this and allow the testing of this fetal tissue, on the other side, I want some support for women who are pregnant before they have an abortion. I want it to be a two-way street there. And so until we're able to provide the kind of society that thinks through these things all the way, we are going to have these ethical challenges that are going to come around from the backside and look at, did we do the right thing rather than did we do the good thing? The problems with as the ethics happen, not when we're trying to decide necessarily between right and wrong. That's pretty easy most of the time. Not all the time with these things, but you know, most of the time we can do right and wrong. We have a problem when we're faced with the difference between what's right and what's good. Then we don't know always which way to go.
Could you be more specific?
Down
support.
Down syndrome. We have a situation where, or here's one that I was just getting into. There's a woman who has cystic fibrosis babies. She has two of them. She has a third baby on the way. She's tested in utero. She wants to know if that baby's going to have cystic fibrosis. If that baby will have cystic fibrosis, she's not going to have that baby. If it doesn't, she will have that baby. She's measuring what's the right thing to do and what's the good thing to do in terms of, can she handle another child? Is that the best thing that can happen for the baby she's already trying to take care of? Is that good for the family? What's the best thing concerning everyone who's involved, versus is it right or wrong to make a decision about the life of this unborn child? So you get into the good of the family versus the right and wrong of whether or not to abort a child that's going to have a particular disease. And those are tough decisions, really tough.
But what support specifically do you want to see in place at the other end that's not being done?
Support for the family that has this kind of situation thrust upon them.
What does support mean?
Well, you see, I think in my mind, I don't know how we do this, but I do believe that we are not individuals who have these things thrust upon us. I think that when this happens to any one of us, we're part of a larger community. And we know that the family unit has changed over the last 20 or 30 years, and we don't live near our parents or our grandparents, and it's a very mobile society. So as a Christian community, what I would propose is that we learn and look for ways to support each other, whether it's within the church or within the community at large that includes several churches, but to come up with support mechanisms so that people who have these situations come to them have the support of the community. And I don't know what that means. I just know that the theory behind it is we don't stand alone when this happens to us.
See, I felt nothing but support when I had my baby.
That's what I would like to see.
And it wasn't just my church. It was churches in the area that knew me one way or the other. I always laughed. It was an interdenominational baby. she had everybody praying.
Did you know ahead of time?
No, I didn't. She didn't show up on any of the tests. And I'm glad about that. I'm glad I had a very nice pregnancy, thinking everything was fine. Other people wanted to be there the way. The staff at the hospital where she was born, I couldn't have gotten any more from them. The ICU unit that she spent 3 months in after open heart surgery adopted us as a family. Multnomah ARC, which is a county chapter of Association for Retarded Persons, whatever I had questions about or needed or wanted or thought about, they were right there. The early intervention program from birth to age 5, we've just shifted over into the public school system. Mm-hmm. If I even think that I want something and have a question, they're there to do that.
And when your child turns 21, will there be group homes for that child to move into? And will that support continue so that we don't have children like this who grow up and reach adult status by age and yet are homeless because the support systems aren't there at that level?
Well, part of that is my job, too. To give back into the support groups and into ARC to make sure that those things 20 years from now will be in place.
Right.
I mean, some of them are in place now. They are.
But we don't have enough. In the state of Ohio, we have 8,000 people on lists waiting to get into a group home. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, and our church tried to get a group home, and we have property across the street from our church that we thought could be used for group home. The neighborhood would not let us do it. Wouldn't give permission.
Well, there's a wonderful public law that came into place, public law IDEA, and it has an enormous amount of clout in it if people just know how to use it. So
it's a federal law?
Yes, it is.
What does it say?
It says that people, especially in the education system, must be placed in the least restrictive environment, which is tremendously open to interpretation.
That was what, 94 or 42? That's back in the 80s, I think.
Well,
60s.
Yeah, but things like this are passed, and the education about the bill doesn't really filter in for at least 10 years. But I'm just curious as to what's not there, because in my situation, in my place of being, I truly don't know what else I would need.
I think that there are some diseases that we respond to, or some communities, perhaps I should even offer that alternative in my own thinking, that respond better than others. And there are other diseases that we just don't treat as nicely or as well. There are an awful lot of kids who are born with diseases whose parents just decide or cannot take care of them. Another kind of mental retardation I know is the alcohol syndrome babies, and those are really hitting the media now. Just in the last year, women who are alcoholics while they're pregnant and the baby's born, and the retardation shows up at about ages 6 or 7 or 8, and the child, because the mother can't take care of the child, the mother's alcoholic, child goes into the foster care system and is bounced. And by age 6 or 7, maybe adopted, maybe not, but the family who adopts the child may not know that that child is retarded. And along with that particular kind of retardation comes all kinds of other things, such as abnormal eating habits, the inability to tie together cause and effect, so the consequences of my behavior I just don't get.
That's the hardest.
That's hard. That's hard. But the eating, I have a friend who literally adopted a little girl like this, who has a chain around her refrigerator and a lock on it, mm-hmm. has to keep everything locked up, including spices, because this child will eat everything. Mm-hmm. Will raw macaroni, ate the cinnamon out of the cinnamon box because it was in a spice rack on the wall, not locked up. And it's not the child's fault. It's not a blame issue. It's not something that you deal with that way. It's part of this particular situation.
Anthony brought up a really good point, I think, why people need to medicate themselves. Figure that part out first, and then, you know, the band-aids for the alcoholism and the drug culture will kind of follow, but until you find out why those are necessary, then...
Yeah, we need to deal with the bigger problems.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Let me move on, because we have another 15 minutes, and cover the rest of this material, but please continue to... While I go off on tangents, continue to interrupt me, and then I'll cover the rest of this, and you can interrupt me any old time. Do we really want to know whether or not we have these particular diseases? When people say they want this test to find out if they have a gene so they can make decisions, they really want to find out they don't have it. The trouble is that 50% of them oftentimes do, particularly with diseases like Huntington, and there's no way to prepare a person for that kind of information. Since people have a 50% chance of really having diseases like Huntington's, when they request the tests, many doctors feel that these people are in denial. So, some researchers suggest a benevolent white lie. The good news or no news option. They say because results can be indeterminate, a person testing positive has no way of knowing if he or she is really positive or is merely indeterminate. The drawbacks of this white lie are that they foster distrust in the physicians.
Especially when they get the disease.
Yeah, and also you can then, again, be in denial and pass the gene on to children that you might bear. So do we really want to know? And here's the consequence of challenging that particular ethical point. Employment screening is a really scary one, I think. Some companies are screening applicants for genetic susceptibility on things like asbestosis and lead poisoning. In general, confidentiality is good because it allows a person to exercise control of their life. As the power of the government grows, however, through computerized information and surveillance techniques, the rights to privacy become more and more important. The President's Commission is championing, a right to have the results of genetic tests held confidential. Several national companies, however, if you've ever heard of this one, Medical Information Bureau of Boston, have you ever heard of that one?
Isn't that the pool of insurers use?
That's right. They tell insurance companies about applicants who are at risk. So there are some times whenever your insurance company pays a bill for you, the doctor sends in what the bill is being sent in for. That information goes to that insurance company. Insurance companies who are connected to the Medical Information Bureau of Boston then regularly dump their pool of computerized information into the Medical Information Bureau of Boston, so that if you can change insurance companies, then this information's in a pool, and say you change jobs and you have Blue Cross here and over here you're going to have Aetna, before the company can insure you, Aetna may be tied into this same bureau. They have all your medical history and they may say, no, we're not going to insure this person for a year or 2 years because we believe they have a pre-existing condition because we know things. And maybe that pre-existing condition was handled. Maybe it's no longer, but at one time, you had surgery for something and it's not pre-existing, but it's perceived to be, well, it could come back. Some diseases are like that. Maybe it's been 5 years since you've had cancer, but you had it, so we're going to make you wait for a couple more years.
I believe an individual has the right to get the medical information.
Yes, we do.
Report.
But
so if I want to know what an insurance company knows about me, I have access to the same report
yes.
that they look at.
That's right. That's right. Just like your credit bureau
sure.
report. Absolutely. We do have that. But this does have an impact on how we're insured in this country. And people who have diseases like Huntington's and who carry the HIV virus are going to be excluded from a risk pool where companies are deciding whether or not they want to hire someone. Already, also, it's crucial to control the scope of who receives these test results. So they have large institutions like the military, like universities and large companies that self-insure. They don't use insurance companies. But this institution then, whether it's a university or the military or a company that self-insures, has information about your medical history. It's not owned by the insurance company, it's all owned by the company you work for. So then what happens? Well, the military screens for the HIV virus in order to exclude recruits. Companies sometimes can keep someone from being on the fast track if they know this person has a particular disease or a disposition toward a disease. People who want to become medical doctors, students might not be able to get into medical programs if they're carrying cystic fibrosis and won't be able to get into the schools of their choice. So all of this information is out there and may keep us from doing what we may want to do.
Do you ever see that the discrimination law will change to include not only race, sex, religion, and all that, but medical status? Do you think that'll ever change?
I don't know.
With the health plan, like the Oregon health plan is, you know, getting ready to.
I don't know. I think if we look at the other countries like England and Canada and some other major countries that have healthcare like, that have the level of healthcare that we have, but have a different system for delivering it and how they're handling it, then this situation doesn't happen. And yes, I think if we move to that kind of system, then I don't think that this will be an issue. But I think as long as we have a situation where we have private providers and private insurance, I think we've got the potential for this kind of situation to continue.
You can almost bet that if there is information, no matter what the law is, someone can buy their way or get their way into it.
Now that's interesting that you said that, because we looked at this very thing in business ethics earlier this week, and what we found, I don't know if all of you were here, but what we found is that we usually don't have a problem with the decision makers on these things, those people out there who make decisions, when a law is involved. If you do it this way, you're breaking the law. When a social issue is involved, we all know you're doing something wrong. But when money's involved, that's where the problems come in.
Anything goes.
Anything goes. You push as far as you can push. And the good gets lost. We somehow lose what's good for one another and for us as a community. That's really what this is about with genetic markers and genetic engineering. It's the good of, or the rights of the individual versus the public good. And we look at those two things and try and balance them, and that's where the tension is. Because we don't have enough information, as you said. We don't have ways to treat these things or to engineer solutions. So even here, we're in the not yet. We have this mapping that's going on, but what do we do with this? We're in the not yet. We can't do anything with it.
It's kind of a gray area.
Very, very, very dark gray.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's real hard to see through this pea soup. The last part of this information is about in utero testing. And this one, I just told you about the mother who had two children who had cystic fibrosis. And whether or not she should have this information about the third child. Some people that having these tests is like telling victims, it would have been better for all of us if you'd not been born. And that's the issue that keeps coming up with those kinds of in utero tests. If you're going to have an in utero test, then you know up front that you're going to have that because you're going to be making a decision. Otherwise, don't get the test done. That's usually what people say. If you're not going to do anything with the information anyway, don't bother with the test. And yet some people say, well, I want the test because I want to know that everything's going to turn out just fine. We talked about pre-employment susceptibility screening, whether or not you can get a job, because all of that information is available out there. And then I'll just give you some last-minute things that we have in terms of the latest stuff on how people that we may have heard of are responding to this. Has anybody ever heard of, or have you all heard of Arlo Guthrie? Do you know who he is? His father, yeah, his father had Huntington's. According to this study, Arlo Guthrie is being used in this study as an example of what to do with Huntington's. He's decided not to have the test for Huntington's. It says he feels he has escaped the trauma which killed his father. He lives today with his wife and four children in Western Massachusetts. Does he regret having children without knowing his status? No, he says. Quote, life is more important than learning about diseases. I could have said I don't want to inflict pain and suffering, but life is wonderful. There's a lot to live for. And Nancy Wexler, who got behind the Huntington's fight, said to people who want to be tested so they can decide, say, whether to go to law school, she says, go to law school. Develop your mind. What are you going to do if you're positive? Spend the rest of your life waiting to be a patient? Those are really the bottom lines of how people feel who have these situations thrust upon them.